Grade 7 Conference, Lecture 35, Medieval History, Part 6. Now that we've heard the stories, the highly encapsulated stories of Eleanor of Aquitaine and Joan of Arc, I'd like to do the kind of review that I would do with the students. So it's no longer in the reviews, just making sure that they've been listening to you and have all the facts straight. By now, your students should be taking notes, certainly in classes like history. And you should be checking those notes once every week or so, especially the boys' notes, making sure they write something, and the girls' notes, making sure that they don't write everything, that the children learn how to differentiate between what's most important and what isn't. And that's a big, big deal for Waldorf students because they're just assuming that every word that you speak is just a pearl of wisdom and it's all the same, it's all of equal value, and you have to tell them that even you sometimes use words like and, the, but, which may not be necessarily a value in your notes, and maybe you use words like or whatever. Anyway, so the facts are there in the notes, we hope, and they are ready now to be speaking out of themselves, to be making judgments, to be assessing and evaluating what they've heard. And this is a skill I think we sometimes overlook. And we, without realizing it, we may be, you know, creating parrots who are very, very good at repeating everything we've said, copying everything we've drawn, but can't really make it their own, which is the whole point of a Waldorf education. So I'd have a discussion with them. What is similar about Joan of Arc and Eleanor, and what's dissimilar? And obviously, of course, at first, the dissimilarities are going to stand out very strongly. Here are some things that I would suggest could be said. Eleanor was born to the nobility. Joan was born very poor and humble. She was elevated to the nobility, however, by King Charles, so that at the time of her death, she was technically of the French nobility. Eleanor was born and died, in a way, absolved herself to some degree, divested herself a bit of her nobility, and died a humble nun. And Joan was born humble and died in the nobility, though under humble circumstances, of course. Eleanor was literate, very unusual for anyone of noble blood in those days, certainly for a woman. She was literate and she was highly educated. Joan was illiterate and had no schooling whatsoever. Eleanor's interests were primarily political and secular. She was at her best when she was intriguing and scheming. The older she got, the more skillful she was at that, and working with her sons to make sure that the right ones got the right amount of power and so on. But she could use religion to forward those interests when she had to. She wanted adventure. She volunteered for the Crusades, even though it wasn't such a welcome deed. She wanted to be involved with the life of Paris. She donated heavily to the construction of a cathedral. She wanted to absolve her marriage to Louis. She lobbied with an abbot and finally with Bernard himself. So she could use religion when she had to. Joan's interests were primarily religious. She did what she did because spiritual beings whom she recognized from her time in church told her to do so. But she had to use secular, political, military means to effect those aims. So Eleanor is secular, but can utilize religion when it suits her. Joan is religious, but is compelled to use secular means. Eleanor, who lived in the Middle Ages, was really the first Renaissance woman. And this is the tension with which she lives for all of her 80 years. She is 200, 300 years ahead of her time, and she's not really understood. She does what she has to do in the age in which she lives, but we can feel her spirit is straining to be in a completely different time. Joan, who was born at the very beginning of the Renaissance, who was born with the Renaissance, was in many ways the last medieval woman. She could still see into the spiritual world. She could still trust those instincts. She had a prophetic sort of power, and she was able to look deeply into things purely out of her faith and purely out of the grace that the spiritual world gave to her. So she too was out of her time. She probably would have been far more accepted had she lived 200-300 years earlier. Might have been very interesting had Joan been born as Eleanor of Aquitaine, and had Eleanor of Aquitaine been born as Joan of Arc. Now, there's some material for a novel. Let's look at their similarities. We can see their absolute polarities, which seventh graders love to show things that are in opposition. But, as William Blake said, opposition is true friendship. Let's see where the amicability, the friendship between the two might have lain. Both Joan and Eleanor were thrust into the whirlwind of world historical events at about the same age, somewhere between 13 and 14. Joan a little earlier, Eleanor a little later, but there they were. The same age as your seventh graders, maybe the same age as an eighth grader, and there they are, taking on not just adult responsibilities, but responsibilities for, you know, an entire kingdom, responsibilities for a tremendous world event that's trying to unfold. Harry Potter's got nothing on these two. Both had the responsibility to guide and to encourage passive kings. And as it happened, kings of the same country. Eleanor had her Louis, and Joan had her Charles. Two men who could hardly put one foot in front of the other without the help of these fiery, choleric women. Both were on the battlefield in their teens. They broke all the rules to do that, and there they both were, resplendent in armor and on horseback. Isn't that incredible? Joan is doing this at about age 16, and Eleanor just at the end of her teens, at age 19, going off on the Crusades. Very remarkable. And both are right at the front of their armies, and neither fights. They are there to boost the morale, to lead and guide the troops, whose nominal commanders, the kings, just can't do it. Both of them had to deal with the intrigue and disapproval of the French court, the same court. Didn't like either of them. They didn't like Eleanor because she was too secular, and they didn't like Joan because she was too religious. Can't please all the people all the time. Both had an interesting destiny with the Cathedral of Saint-Denis. For Eleanor, it was the perhaps the grandest gesture that she made, short of offering up the lives of thousands of her followers to the Crusades, but it was helping to build this new monument to spirituality. And for Joan, that was where she laid down her sword and surrendered in that crucial battle in Paris that greatly weakened her hold on the destiny of France. Both were loved by the common people, and both were hated by the nobility. Both were deeply involved in the powerful destiny of the English and French folk souls. They both dealt with people who spoke French and people who spoke some English anyway, and were involved with the entangled destinies of both of those lands. And both fought on behalf of France at one time or another, and both were imprisoned by the English. In the case of Eleanor, of course, one Englishman in particular, but he's a pretty powerful Englishman, the king himself. And in the case of Joan, more complicated political machinations involving Burgundy as well as the British, but nonetheless, same scenario. So look at those similarities. Here they are. We might say they're like twins separated at birth and separated, 300 years apart from one another. What a remarkable, remarkable interwoven picture. So this is, of course, why I wish that you could teach both of these figures. Perhaps you taught Eleanor last year, and when you teach Joan, you might want to recollect some things about Eleanor. But as I've said earlier, if you haven't taught Eleanor, I hope that the little I've been able to share with you here gives you some second thoughts about that. She's more of a Renaissance figure than about half the artists that you're going to teach, and much more of a Renaissance figure than some of the Medicis, who are in many ways, still working out of ancient Roman history. So certainly if you can do that, that would be a wonderful thing. But keep this comparison in mind. And I hope that as I speak about the various, political, religious, and above all, artistic figures that we're going to encounter in the Renaissance, sometimes I'll do these sorts of comparisons, but I hope that you are thinking about this yourself, how you might, for example, take up, let's say, Leonardo and Michelangelo, or how you might take up two of the popes, or whatever, how to do this in a way of comparing and contrasting, your good old college assignment, but in a very genuine way, to live with the nature of the seventh grader, which delights in polarities, but which is also longing for their resolution.